Hey, I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on the Civic Media Radio Network and at civicmedia.us. Today, we're going to continue probing the so-called rural-urban divide, which I began last time when I interviewed UW professor Kathy Kramer, the author, of course, of The Politics of Resentment. Now, for this one, I'm talking with Mike McCabe, who wrote Blue Jeans in High Places, and with Bill Hogseth, organizing director of a group called GROW, which stands for Grassroots Organizing of Western Wisconsin. So let's get going. Joining me now is Mike McCabe, the former executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. He's written two nonfiction books, including Blue Jeans in High Places. And now he's got a fun first novel out entitled Miracles Along County Q, which I just finished this morning, I gotta say. You can hear him every Wednesday morning at 7:30 a.m. on the John and Gordy Show on WMDX in Madison. And on the Civic Media app, of course. Mike McCabe, welcome to the Wisconsin Forward podcast.
Good to be with you, Matt.
You know, I was thinking back, must have been 12, 13 years ago. You were at the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. I was at the Progressive. And we were both speaking at a place up north, small town. You spoke first and then I spoke. So I got to hear you speak. And you said something that I hadn't heard before, which was that the Democratic Party has a brand problem. Of course, now everybody's talking about the Democratic Party having a brand problem. What did you mean by that and how did you detect it?
Well, part of the brand problem at that time just was that the Democrats were known as the party of government. And for people in rural areas, there's always been strong anti-government sentiment. They're people who believe in self-reliance and self-sufficiency, and they, you know, there's this sense of pride. You don't want welfare or relief, as they would call it. And even when they need the help, they take it only reluctantly. And so there's just this feeling that there's a suspicion about government and a sense that, you know, just leave us alone. Let us live our lives the way we want to live. And the Democratic Party had really become identified as the party of government. And so in rural communities, that was a brand problem. But I think more broadly, and now we see it in much sharper contrast, what I noticed back then was that the Democrats were losing the working class. Slowly, ever so slowly, but surely, they were losing support among working class people. And the dividing line was really whether you were college educated or not college educated. And the Democratic Party was increasingly becoming the party of the college educated. And my dad had an eighth grade education and had a real problem with me going off to college when I decided to do that. I think it hurt him deeply, and he tried to talk me out of it. And college-educated friends of mine would hear that story. Your parents tried to talk you out of going to college. They thought that was a bad thing. And I said, well, you know, that's part of the culture there. And so there was that dividing line, too, that I was noticing back then. And you can feel it much more sharply now because it goes beyond rural America. It's working class populations in general, and one of those dividing lines is education.
Hmm. It's interesting you mentioned that the Democratic Party was identified as the party of government. I'm thinking back to the New Deal, where the party of government, FDR, the Democrats, the government was solving people's problems.
Yep.
And they could, if you were the party of the government, that was a good thing. And the government was working for working people, and they could identify people would have two pictures up in their little houses. One would be of Jesus and the other would be of FDR.
Exactly. And my dad, with the eighth grade education, he was born in 1919, lived through the Depression, went to World War II, fought in World War II. He only ever once voted for a Republican, and that was Dwight Eisenhower. Mm. Other than that, he worshipped FDR. And measured every candidate he ever voted for the rest of his life by the extent to which that candidate reminded him of FDR. Hmm. And so Roosevelt was a looming figure. But there was a situation where I think they did feel that president used the power of government to help people like him, people like he and his neighbors.
Yeah, and that relates to something else I've often heard you say, that the Democratic Party, when they were in power, unlike in FDR's time, didn't deliver tangibly to people so that people could say, yes, thank you to whichever Democrat was in power for giving us this. And except for the Affordable Care Act, which is highly flawed because it's not Medicare for all, it's hard for me, it's hard for anybody really to identify what has the Democratic Party delivered for you, and especially if you're a working person who has seen the jobs flee, or in your novel, they've seen their small town decimated by the paper mills dying and the big farms taking over everything, and the small town's not what it used to be. It's just hard for people to say it makes a difference who you voted for.
Yeah, it is hard to come up with a list of achievements that rival Social Security and Medicare and all, and the and you know,
rural electrification,
the GI Bill, all of those things that my dad looked at and said, well, that helps us. We all benefit from that. It's hard to come up with a comparable list over the course of the last 50 years or so.
I want to get also back to what you said about the divide between educated, college educated and non-college educated. In your novel, even you describe Madison as a place where people look down upon other folks because, you know, they're highly educated here. And and this resembles Kathy Kramer's book, The Politics of Resentment. So it's a resentment feeling looked down upon or ignored.
One of the things I hear from left of center audiences really frequently, and it's usually phrased in the form of a question, is why are these rural people voting against their own interests? I hear it all the time.
And how do you respond to that?
I really have two responses. First of all, my initial response is, no, they're not. They're voting for their interests as they define their interests. And you don't get to define their interests. You might think that they're voting against their interests, but that's based on how you think they should think. And they get to decide for themselves what their values are and what how they define their interests. But my other answer is that we all vote against our own interests. So, you know, you really are demeaning them for behavior that we ourselves engage in. I've been lucky. I've never applied for unemployment compensation. I've never had to make a workers' comp claim because I was injured in a workplace. I've never been on food stamps. But I support those programs and those policies. So it could easily be said, you're voting against your own self-interest. You haven't personally benefited from that. So why are you supporting politicians who advance those kinds of policies? We all will make decisions about what we think is for the greater good or what is beneficial for our society as a whole, even if we don't personally benefit from those programs. Rural people are no different. They think about their values and they think about who will advance those values best. And yeah, sometimes it means that something where they could actually benefit from gets cut or you know doesn't get continued. But when they're disparaged for voting against their own interests, you know what I tell audiences is that they hear you. They know you think that about them, and it drives a wedge between you and them. It helps create that rural-urban divide, and there is tremendous resentment because what they hear when they hear somebody say you're voting against your own interests, what they hear is you're stupid.
You're an idiot. Right.
And the fact is, we all will make decisions sometimes about how we vote or who we support in elections that might work against our own personal self-interest.
So it's a values thing more than an economic calculation.
Absolutely, it's a values thing. And I think now it's gotten corrosive enough, the rural-urban divide has gotten corrosive enough, that if this politician is with them, those people who look down on us, I'll vote for the other side. Because I don't want to be in their tribe. I don't want to be among them because they think so little of us. And that's where it really gets poisonous. And I think we're basically at that point.
Talk a little bit more about the appeal that Donald Trump has had And I'm not talking about the far right neo-Nazis, the person who has a swastika on their bicep or flies a Confederate flag at the back of their pickup truck, but otherwise seemingly decent folks voting for Trump.
See, I actually think I've had thousands of conversations with Trump supporters and people who, you know, are from the area where I grew up. They're largely Trump supporters, and I've talked with so many of them. And the interesting thing is there's no two alike. No two Trump supporters alike. They come to him for different reasons. They reach him through different doors. But I think one of the common characteristics of Trump support is that they want to, you know, they basically want to flip the bird to the political establishment, and he's the biggest middle finger they could find. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, he wants to blow stuff up, and they want to blow stuff up. So this is a real strongly populist moment where people want, they want upheaval, they want radical change. And they see the Democrats as being sort of the party of the status quo. Steady as she goes, keep things the way they are, keep the programs moving along the same lines they've been moving the last 50, 60, 70 years. And people are thinking, but this isn't working for us anymore. Our town is dying. I'm losing work. I'm having a hard time supporting my family. And I don't know how the heck I'm going to go to the doctor if somebody in family gets sick because I don't have health insurance. And they're thinking, we got to do something dramatic. We got to shake things up. And they feel like the Democrats have taken a more moderate or safe approach. They see the status quo being reinforced. And so it's basically, when you think about Hillary Clinton was put up against Donald Trump, who better epitomizes the political establishment than Hillary Clinton?
Right.
Then Joe Biden, same thing. And so I don't think it's that they love Donald Trump. I don't think it's that they even like Donald Trump. It's that they see Donald Trump as somebody who's gonna blow things up. And they saw Clinton and Biden as people who would kind of keep things the way they are. And the way things are is not working for them.
Mm-hmm. I think a cohort loves them, but the wider Trump appeal.
You're right.
Gets to where you are. And I think your point about Clinton and Biden, and also, I mean, Kamala Harris, and I don't blame her. She mm-hmm. was given a terrible deck to play with. But the decision to go, Liz Cheney to Bernie Sanders or Liz Cheney to Elizabeth Warren, we're all in this together, might have told people, with the exception maybe of Bernie, that, you know, this is the establishment. You know, let's keep things. These mm-hmm. guys are crazy on the other side. Trump's mm-hmm. crazy. You know, we'll have a steady hand on the wheel. You know, people don't want the steady hand on the wheel.
But there, again, when you talk about the education dividing line, college-educated people are feeling better about where the country is and where the country's headed than working-class people have been feeling. And so college-educated people are going to be more likely to say, yeah, you know, Hillary will, you know, she'll be a steady hand, guiding the ship. And they felt the same way about Biden. Let's just keep things calm. Let's keep things steady. And then there are people who are feeling desperation, and they're saying, that's lethal to us. We need to really uproot things and really shake this thing to its roots. And Trump embodied that. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you know, regard and policy is kind of an abstraction here. It's more a leadership style that they were drawn to.
And a sense that he understands me, or he gets it. He at some gut level.
Yeah, exactly.
And they understood that from Bernie too. That's why there was some overlap there.
That was the amazing thing, is I talked to so many people who said I could go Sanders or I could go Trump. In 2016, Sanders would be great. Trump would be great. Well, when you think of it in an academic way, put them on a traditional political spectrum, the two are on opposite ends of that spectrum. But that's not what people were feeling. They sensed that Bernie got it, and that he was ready to go in there and really shake things up. And they got that same sense from Trump. And when Bernie wasn't an option, Trump became their remaining option.
Mm, yeah, there we are. We've talked about the urban-rural divide. How do we bridge it?
I think part of it is just through greater understanding. One of the things that I hear all the time, people say, well, you know, they only vote the way they are because they're racist, or because they're misogynist, or because they're homophobes, or whatever. The interesting thing is that I can tell you, growing up in Clark County, people were more socially conservative then than they are now. They're more accepting of gay families now than they were then. They are more accepting of gender equality now than they were then. And yet they were electing Democrats back then, and now they're solidly voting for Republicans. And as far as race, if race determines their vote, then how do you explain Barack Obama in 2008? He won dozens and dozens of rural counties in Wisconsin and became president as a result. How do you explain why Tammy Baldwin also won dozens of rural counties in Wisconsin? An out lesbian gets elected over Tommy Thompson, a four-term governor. And they chose Tammy Baldwin in a lot of rural counties. You know, in my own hometown, the little town our farm was closest to is a town named Curtis. About 150 people then, all white. Today, it is a majority-minority community. The majority is Latino. So I think people need to understand that rural communities are not like, you know, Mayberry RFD. It's a different world out there. And you know, if you say that they only vote the way they are because they're racist, the majority of people in Curtis are not white. And they are voting for Trump.
And it speaks to just the dismissiveness, again, the condescending attitude, patronizing attitude that people have when they just paint with such a broad brush.
Yeah. It is, and that's the thing, is rural communities are complicated. They're very stratified. Not everybody thinks alike. Not everybody looks alike. Not everybody acts alike. And that's one of the things I tried to capture in my novel was the stratification of rural communities and people who lived up on the hill and were sort of looked down on the rest of the community. And that's very pronounced in rural communities. They are complicated places. And I think the more we are willing to open our minds to that complication, the closer we'll get to an understanding of rural life that can help us, live in harmony politically with people. And the other thing I would say is that I remember a time when Democrats were representing those communities. Dave Obie was the member of Congress. Tom Harnish was the state senator. Frank Nicolay, one of the most progressive members of the state assembly ever, was from Neillsville, representing Clark County in the state assembly. And FDR was a revered figure. Today, the word Democrat is a curse word, and they don't want anything to do with a liberal or a Democrat. But that will change. They'll tire of when Republicans don't deliver for them, don't make their lives demonstrably better. That will change, and there'll be that shift. And I'm old enough to have seen that shift occur, from rural Wisconsin being a Democratic stronghold to now Clark County is as red as any county in America. It is solidly Republican, but that will shift.
Mike McCabe has been my guest on this Wisconsin Forward podcast. His novel, which I highly recommend, a really good read, Miracles Along County Q. Mike McCabe, thanks for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
Great to see you. With me now is Bill Hogseth. He's the organizing director at a great group called GROW, Grassroots Organizing of Western Wisconsin. Bill Hogseth, welcome to the Wisconsin Forward podcast.
Hey, Matt. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, I really wanted to pick your brain on, you know, what's going on in communities across Wisconsin that are not in the urban centers of Madison or Milwaukee. I know for some folks who live in those cities, you know, they can't really relate to what's going on in rural Wisconsin or small town Wisconsin. And I know you've been plowing those fields for years now and may be able to help us out. First of all, I wanted to just get your sense as to why rural counties in Wisconsin lurched toward the Republican Party over the last two decades. Not so much the last 4 years, but in the 15, 16 years prior to that, there was a big move toward the right. What accounts for that?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would just say is that rural voters are not a monolith. It's not just like we have a block of rural voters in one county or another county, and they all go this way or that way. It's actually, I think it's really complex. And I think it's not just who's voting which way, but it's also who's like staying home on election day and who's not voting or who is voting that wasn't voting prior. So like when you compare one election to another, I think there's actually more complexity than just like, oh, the whole community marched towards the right or the left. In my county, which is in Dunn County, my county went with Obama for 08 and 12, and then went for Trump in the last three elections in 16, 20, and 24. And like, just, I can speak only from my experience, because I'm not like a political scientist, but my sense is that the reaction to the way the economy has been going for regular people in rural communities has created a situation where people are just fed up with politics, and they are very open to a narrative that says that let's just blow it all up. And that makes a lot of sense when you've been living in a situation where your community has, I mean, there's been like economic upheaval over the last 40 years in my community. I'm 44 years old. And just from when I was born in 1980 to right now, we've basically lost the entire dairy economy in a county like ours. The time I was born, there were 1,100 dairy farms in my county. Mm. Now there are 70. That is an entire way of life that like supported, you know, basically small businesses that supported entire families, that has like gone away.
I mean, that's shrunk by, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. That's a shrinkage of more than 90%.
Yeah. I mean, it's devastating. It's like, it's hard to like really explain in words, like how that is basically flipping upside down in the entire like structure of a local economy. And when you have that kind of upheaval, where people are suddenly, kind of cast off to figure out how to make a living, you look for answers. And why is what's happening in my community happening? Why are there so many empty barns on the way into town now? Why is the main street hollowing out? Why are many of our neighbors succumbing to addiction? Why is it harder to earn a living when you're still working three jobs? So like, it just makes you really susceptible to just blowing up the system. I think that's what I would say.
And Trump was the guy who was blowing up the system. You mentioned there are some people who, if they didn't vote for Trump, maybe they stayed home. Who is staying home?
Yeah, I mean, let's just remember that like we the United States actually has pretty low voter turnout when compared to other industrialized democracies across the world. You know, we're usually at like 65% of eligible voters. That's not actually a lot to celebrate. There's a whole chunk of people who just see no value in politics, because whether it's a Democrat in the White House or whether it's a Republican in the White House, from many people's perspectives, they don't see much changing in their town. So who are those people? I think they're just regular people. Mm-hmm. I think they're just regular people who've made an analysis that's really not that irrational, that politics doesn't produce real outcomes for them. And so these are people who I think have made they've seen both parties not deliver for them.
Right.
And I think that's a really, really important piece of this, because I don't think it's just Trump. I don't think it's just Obama. I think it's the whole political system as it's set up right now, where it's soaked in money, where it's really driven by consultants, where it's basically this mass marketing campaign. People can tell when it's kind of hollowed out, and they don't really believe in it anymore. And these are people I talk to, by the way. I mean, we do a lot of door knocking at Grow, and we talk about these issues with people at their doorsteps. And this is just what I hear from how people are making sense of the way things are right now.
Well, it makes total sense to me. I mean, people are fed up with politics as usual. They're fed up with politicians as usual. I mean, it's not a shocker to me that two of the most popular politicians over the last 10 years have been Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, because they're not typical politicians. One guy wasn't a politician at all, and Bernie's such an atypical politician since he's right out there with his grumpy old socialist self, you know, and just says what's on his mind. So I think people appreciate that and want that, and they don't want the consultant or the prepackaged plastic politician, and they want answers to their problems. And that's where demagogues can come in so easily, as we've seen with Trump. Tell me more about what you're hearing when you're going door to door. What's the first question that you ask people? How do they respond?
Well, I mean, we go door to door for different issues and different reasons. But I mean, one question we always ask people is like, how are problems showing up in your daily life? Like literally what's keeping you up at night? We really want to get into people's experiences and hear how, hear their stories basically. And so we always start every conversation from that standpoint. Last year, we were doing a lot of door knocking around the issue of housing. And it was like, what's keeping you up about housing? And we heard, you know, some people their rent is going up. Some people it's like there's black mold in their apartment. Some people feel trapped in their house because they raised a family in a house and then all the kids left and they want to downsize, but they can't find anything that's affordable. And it, you know, there's so many issues, and it's just such a human issue, housing, that's where we start rather than, well, what do you think about this policy or that policy? Or what do you think about this party or that party? We start with people.
And neither party has been really addressing the housing issue squarely. Kamala Harris kind of waved at it in the 100 days that she was running, but she didn't really make it real clear to people how she was going to help other than try to build a few more, you know, 5 million houses or 1 million houses, whatever it was. But for folks who are, you know, trapped in a house with mold or who can't pay their property tax or can't sell their house because there's not an affordable house in the county or in the town they're living in, that really wasn't an answer, certainly short term anyhow. Why do you think the Democratic Party, for instance, has not been hearing these issues as loudly as you hear them every day when you knock on doors?
I don't know. It's hard for me to know why things are the way they are with the Democratic Party, why they do what they do. So it's really hard for me to say. But I do know that like an issue like housing, one thing I do want to say about this like question around the urban and rural divide, and I think housing is a way of illustrating this, is that I think that the rural and the urban divide is kind of a myth. And I think it is a myth that's intentionally perpetuated.
Why?
To keep us divided. You know, if you're a part of a ruling class and you want to maintain your position, you intentionally look for ways to divide people. And you see with housing, many people think it's an urban issue. But when you go door to door in a town, in towns like around where we are, and even in the rural townships, you hear that people are experiencing the exact same stuff that people in areas where I live, as they are in Milwaukee or Madison. Now, I don't knock doors in Milwaukee or Madison, but I talk to people who do live there and I do read about it. And it's the same issues. And what I see is that, what are the reasons that housing isn't getting built in a rural area is often the same reason that housing supply isn't getting built in an urban area. And it's because housing is a commodity and housing is become not just a roof over your head. It's a financial instrument. It's a mortgage, you know, and that's used by private equity and banks to, you know, deliver profits for their shareholders. And so when something is a commodity, there's always going to be an incentive to keep supply low because that's what keeps prices high and that's what drives profits. So when you ask something like why are the Democrats like not delivering on this or not hearing people's issues, it kind of brings me back to the profit motive and the way our economy is structured. And when you think about it from that way, like rural and urban people are basically getting squeezed in the exact same way, by the exact same forces in our economy. It just looks differently. And so painting that picture of like urban and rural people are different is actually totally false. And I think that the more we can try to build a bridge between rural and urban as an organizer, I think that could unlock like a really, really serious political force in this country that could deliver some real gains for people.
And how do you build that bridge?
Listening.
Mm-hmm. It's always a good start.
Yeah. And then also just like getting people together in the same room. It's like so often like we get siloed off and we don't interact with people who are different than us. So like, you know, as organizers, we're constantly trying to do that in small ways and big ways. And just, I think at some point when I'm in rooms with organizers who are organizing in Milwaukee and Madison, I learn a lot just hearing their perspectives. And I know they learn a lot hearing our perspectives. And I think the more we can create those kind of spaces and then start strategizing together and start planning together and looking towards the future with an imagination about how can you bridge rural and urban people into a political coalition, I think a lot could happen if that were the case.
Yeah, I look forward to that. And just as the urban-rural divide may be to some degree manufactured, so too this division between red counties and blue counties.
Yeah.
I really, you know, you can look at a map of Wisconsin after an election and they'll paint a whole county red or a whole county blue. And it bugs me so much because I've been to, you know, all over Wisconsin to almost every county. You know, even if on the map it's a red county, you know, there are a lot of people who aren't agreeing with Trump or the Republican Party or Scott Walker or whoever from the Republicans is leading the state or the country and are doing great work. And so just to paint a county in one color is so totally misleading. Doesn't that bother you too?
Yeah. Well, and it also just like ignores the reality of politics, which is that it's always shifting and moving. And it's like politics is not this like static monolithic thing. I mean, like you basically take a picture of an area's political leanings. You take a snapshot of that on election day, but it doesn't paint the whole picture because it's like, it's a fluid thing that's moving throughout the year, throughout time. And I just look at my own county and just think about how much it's changed. And it was just a blue county not long ago. And as political conditions change, voting patterns will also change. And it's just basically a reflection, I think, of how are people making sense of the pain that they're experiencing in the world and like the way it's connected to the economy, the way it's connected to politics, and the way people make sense of that is going to drive their behavior.
And part of the way they make sense of that, it depends on the media that they consume. And are you noticing kind of a siloed media diet from people up there?
Yeah, I mean, that's such an interesting thing for me because, you know, I also, like, I've had to recognize that I'm in my own various information silos. And, like, as I organize and I organize with people from different generations, I'm hearing where they get their information. And I have kids and I hear where they get their information. And one thing I just definitely know is that I can't really fully understand the information landscape as one person because right. It is so fractured and so complicated now. And there's a million places where you can kind of go to get your information. So that's just like such an interesting part of the political moment we're in right now.
And one
other thing I just wanted to say about like kind of the fallacy of red and blue counties too, is that it also presumes that the red and the blue are static things. Like there's this constant realignment and alignment of what these parties are and who they're speaking to or who they're not speaking to. I mean, you've seen like the Democratic Party kind of abandon working class voters. You've also seen the resources that they put into rural organizing decline. And you see, I mean, the Republican Party too has also undergone this massive shift. So what is a red county or a blue county just seems like a really simplistic way of looking at it.
Yeah, I totally resist those terms myself. How long have you been at grassroots organizing in Western Wisconsin?
Well, I've been at GROW for 3 years, and the organization was started in 2020 by a group of folks outside of River Falls who got together around the farm table and saw some things they wanted to change in their community, and they started organizing, and one thing led to another, and they had some success and some energy created through some of the campaigns, and we're now an organization with staff. We cover 7 counties. We do issue campaigns where we work on housing, we work on industrial agriculture, we help people get elected to local government, and we really, really focus everything we do on developing leaders from within our community to become basically, agents within the public arena, whether that's like trying to pass an ordinance through a city council or, like I said, trying to get elected. We feel like the more leaders that we have in this moment is what's going to make the difference, because right now we need not just like one big charismatic leader. We need thousands of leaders. So the way we develop them is by organizing.
Yeah, local homegrown leaders. You can't beat that. Well, that's it for today. I'm Matt Rothschild, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Wisconsin Forward podcast on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thanks again to Bill Hogseth and Mike McCabe for being my guests. And thanks to my excellent new producer, Dom Lee, for polishing everything up. Please check out civicmedia.us to find my next podcast and for other terrific offerings as we continue to foster civic dialogue about our democracy right here in the Badger State.